Om sahana vavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahavityan karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavitvishavahai. Om shanti, shanti, shanti. Katakshakiranachanta naman mohabdaye namaha ananta nanda krishnaya jagan mangala murtaye. Welcome to our webcast of our Tuesday Vedanta class. We're going through Advaita Makaranda. We're going to continue today with verse 6. And the pattern of the text after the first couple of verses, the pattern of the text is to introduce, the commentator will introduce a doubt. The Purva Paksha, the Paksha, the point of view, which is Purva, here means opposed to our Siddhanta. Siddhanta means what Advaita Vedanta teaches. So we begin with the Purva Paksha, simply means doubt. We begin with the doubt, and then we proceed to use the verse to remove that doubt. And we've talked several times already about how we have so many doubts because our minds are really powerful. Our intellects are powerful enough to discover all kinds of possible problems and defects which give rise to doubts, and all of those doubts have to be removed. What's interesting, I don't think I've given this metaphor previously, doubts are born from the improper use of logic. If our logic was perfect, we'd have no doubts. Our logic is anything but perfect. So, based on our imperfect logic, doubts come up. And we resolve those doubts with proper logic. So, doubts born of improper logic, those doubts are dismissed by the use of proper logic. And there's a lovely metaphor that's used to describe this. If you're going down a road and a thief is standing in the road with a big stick, and that thief is threatening to beat you with the stick and rob you, how to deal with that thief? Well, a good technique would be to grab the stick from the thief and beat the thief with his own stick. That stick represents logic. So the stick of logic is first wielded by the thief, that is the improper use of logic. And what we do with the help of these verses is we grasp that stick of logic away from the thief and we employ it properly, using these teachings to dismiss our doubts. So the doubts born of improper logic are dismissed by the use of proper logic as we're guided through that process by this text. So to introduce our sixth verse, the doubt, let's see the verse first, and then and then I'll introduce the doubt. Repeat after me. Abharupasya vishvasya, abharupasya vishvasya, bhanam bhasannidhirvina, bhanam bhasannidhirvina, kadachinnavakalpeta, kadachinnavakalpeta, bhachaham tena sarvagaha, bhachaham tena sarvagaha. Excuse me. Before we see the words of the verse, here let me introduce the doubt. The teachings of Vedanta, and we've discussed this particular topic several times in this text and extensively in the Atma Bodha text, which we took previously. We've established at great length that consciousness, the consciousness present in your experience right now, the consciousness by which you know what's going on right now, that consciousness is not stuck inside your head. That consciousness is not stuck inside your body. That consciousness has no edge or boundary or size or limit. That consciousness is all pervasive, limitless, pervades the cosmos. We've established that with the help of Vedantic teachings and with the help of logic. Of course, we can have plenty of doubts regarding the all-pervasiveness of that consciousness. For example, based on our own experience, consciousness doesn't seem all-pervasive. Based on the experience of our bodies, for example, consciousness seems confined to our bodies. So this is a very reasonable doubt to have. If Vedanta says that consciousness is all pervasive, how to deal with the doubt that consciousness experientially seems confined to our bodies, and that's dealt with in this verse. We're, by the way, we're going to be using a lot of logic, reasoning, analysis in this verse and even more in the next verse. Remember, this is an advanced class on Advaita Vedanta. We're dealing with Manana and Nididhyasana. So I know you're ready for that. So we're okay. So here, in the third line, Na avakalpeta, starting in the middle of the third line, there is no possibility, na avakalpeta, no possibility, no way to imagine, kadachit, at any time, in any manner whatsoever, it is impossible to imagine, second line, bhanam, the appearance of what? First line, vishwasya, the world, the appearance of the world. It is impossible to imagine the appearance of the world, vishvasya, the world which is abharupasya. You can see the word bha in abharupa and bhanam. And in the final line, you'll also see bha. Bha is a verbal root to shine or appear. Therefore, bhanam can mean shining or appearance. A better translation in this context is actually experience. When I appear before you, but that's only using your power of sight. You can also hear me. If you were physically here, you could touch me, etc. So bhanam, literally appearance, but contextually experience. And up above, abharupasya, that which has no bha, no shining, no appearance, no consciousness. So by extension, bha, shining, also means the shining of consciousness. So abharupasya vishvasya, for the universe, which is abharupa, which is by nature insentient. For the universe, which is by nature insentient, there is na avakalpeta, there is no possibility of bhanam, of the appearance of universe, bha sannidhehi vina, second line. Vina, without, bha sannidhi. Sannidhi means presence, and here's our word bha again, without the presence of bha consciousness. So what is he saying here in the first part of the verse? He says that there is abharupasya vishvasya, for the insentient universe. Kadachit na avakalpeta, there is no possibility of bhanam, of appearance. There is no possibility for the appearance of the insentient universe, bha-sannidhehi vina, without the present sannidhi of bha, of consciousness. I'll paraphrase it. This is very sophisticated Vedantic teachings. The meaning is not that complicated. What he's saying is that there's no possibility for experience of the universe. The universe is insentient. There's no possibility to experience the insentient universe unless there's sentiency, unless there's consciousness. If there was no sentiency, if there's no consciousness, how can anything be experienced? The universe in and of itself is insentient. Therefore, it requires consciousness to be experienced. This much makes sense. Just like for something that is not self-shining, my body is not self-shining. In order to see my body, you need light. Light makes my non-shining body appear. So my non-shining body represents the universe. So for the non-sentient universe, you require consciousness, the light of consciousness, for that universe to be revealed. Now this much is fairly straightforward. Where this verse goes, however, is a little bit more sophisticated. What it means is that the universe possesses knownness. Pujya Swami Dayananda loved to use that word, knownness. The universe possesses knownness. Knownness in the sense that the insentient universe is known by a conscious being, you and me. So since a conscious being can know the universe can be known by a conscious being, therefore we say the universe has knownness. What that means, however, is wherever there is knownness, there is consciousness. There's a little bit of logic here. Wherever there is knownness, there is consciousness. I am known to you. So there's consciousness here. In a manner of speaking, your consciousness reaches me. Of course, there is the camera and your computer and whatever in between. But in a manner of speaking, your consciousness reaches me. So consciousness has this unique quality of being able to reach whatever is known. The entire universe is known because consciousness can reach the universe. The commentator gives, by the way, these verses really are almost impossible to interpret without the help of a commentary, and the commentary is quite good. I won't be teaching the commentary, but I do rely upon it quite a bit. So the commentator says that when you look up into the sky at night, you see the moon and stars. How far away is the moon? The moon is, if I remember right, 250,000 miles away. How far away are the stars? Billions and billions of miles away, light years away. When you look up at the sky, you see the stars and moon, which are so distant, but your consciousness reaches them. Now, here we have to understand the pre-scientific understanding of perception. And here we're dealing with a complexity, because the way the ancient rishis understood perception, sight, for example, and the way we understand today in modern times is very different. For example, in modern times, when you look at the moon, for example, the light from the moon reaches your eyes, it's focused on the retina, that the nerve impulses go to your brain and you see the moon. We understand this very well according to modern science. But the ancient rishis didn't know anything about light being focused on by the lenses on your eyes, being focused on the retina of your eyeballs, and then the neurons carrying the impulses to your brain. The rishis understood nothing about that. They had a very different concept about how perception works. They understood perception in this way. Your power of sight, which is sukshma, subtle. Sukshma, like sukshma sharira, the subtle body. That which is stula is physical. Your body is physical. Your eyeballs are physical. Your retinas are physical. But the power of sight is not physical. And the way the ancient rishis understood sight is your non-physical power of sight, not your eyeballs, the power of sight being non-physical, it could extend itself from your physical body. Remember, it's non-physical. It's not stuck inside your body. They envisioned that your power of sight could stretch out from your eyes and contact whatever you're looking at. So your power of sight can reach out from your eyes 250,000 miles and contact the moon, allowing you to see the moon. Or your power of sight could reach out through your eyes light years, billions and billions of miles, reach the stars and allow you to see the stars. This is how the ancients understood it. I know it's radically different from how we understand things today. You don't have to accept it. It's not true from a scientific standpoint. But in order to understand this text, Lakshmidhara understood perception in the way I'm describing it now, as the ancient rishis understood it. So in order to understand Lakshmidhara's text, we have to understand it the way he looked at perception. So from his standpoint, when your power of sight stretches out to the moon and stars, along with your power of sight is consciousness. Your consciousness reflected in your power of sight. Oh, this is so complicated. I'm sorry. Consciousness is reflected in your mind. We've had this discussion before. It's reflected in all powers of your mind, all aspects of your mind, including your power of sight. So your power of sight extends itself to the moon and stars, and consciousness is reflected in that power of sight, which is in contact with the moon and stars. Thereby, the moon and stars become known to you. Now, the point is that this, based on this ancient pre-scientific way of understanding the perception, sight, it establishes that consciousness can reach to the stars and moon, which is why he concludes in the last line, Tena, because of this, therefore, that chaham cha aham cha, and tena, therefore, aham, I am bha. Here bha means consciousness. I am bha consciousness, which is sarvagaha, which is all pervasive. Therefore, I am all pervasive consciousness. So just to try to tie this together, it's rather sophisticated. So we opened our discussion of this verse with the doubt. Vedanta says consciousness is all pervasive, but I only experience consciousness inside my body. So here he gives a logical argument for consciousness being outside your body, for consciousness reaching to the stars and moon, based on this pre-scientific model of perception. So he's using logic. based on this pre-scientific model of perception to prove the presence of your consciousness outside of your body, reaching to the stars and moon and beyond. Now, of course, in modern times, we know very well that this model of perception with your power of sight extending out through your eyes is silly. We don't accept it at all. We know how sight works. And your power of sight is entirely inside your eyeballs and body and brain. We know this very clearly. So what we would say then is this manner of using logic doesn't work in modern times, but it does still make a valid point. And what the valid point is that the reach of your experience depends on the limitations of your senses. So in Lakshmidhara's view, your power of sight could reach out to the stars. Therefore, you can experience all the way out to the stars. Here, in modern times, we know that power of sight doesn't extend out to the stars. Power of sight is inside your eyeballs and brain. So then, our experience is of whatever is in our minds. And this is a different perspective here. We're trying to establish the all-pervasive nature of consciousness. Experience says it's stuck inside your body and mind. The logic he gave, based on the pre-scientific model of perception, that explanation proves the presence of consciousness beyond the body. That particular proof doesn't work in modern times, so we have to take another perspective. If we have to look in modern times, we understand everything you see, everything you experience is in your mind. Everything you experience is within your mind. We've been through this many times. Everything you experience is picked up by your five senses. Whatever your five senses pick up, it is all collected inside your brain, and through some mystery that even modern science can't figure out, all of those neurons firing in your brain gives rise to what we call mind, what we experience. Even today, science cannot explain how your mind arises from your brain. It's one of the biggest challenges in neuroscience today, and they are clueless. You find an honest neuroscientist and they'll admit they're clueless. They actually call it the hard question of consciousness. They call it the hard question because they have no answer. So, from a modern scientific standpoint, we can still say consciousness pervades the universe, but we say it in a different manner. The universe you experience is the universe in your mind. We've had this discussion before. The universe you experience indirectly by means of your five senses is all out there, extending out to the moon and stars. But the universe you experience directly is inside your mind. The moon and stars that you experience are the moon and stars inside your mind. That universe is present within your mind, and that universe in your mind is pervaded by consciousness. This is another interpretation of this verse to solve this problem. So the ancient worldview of perception worked very well for them. In modern times, it doesn't work. So we have to update our interpretation of this verse. The commentator doesn't help with that. But we update it and we can establish the all-pervasiveness of consciousness by saying everything you experience is present in your mind. Whatever is present in your mind, that universe present in your mind, is pervaded by consciousness. Therefore, consciousness is not stuck inside your body. When you look at the stars, stars are billions of miles away, fine, but the stars in your mind, the universe in your mind, is pervaded by consciousness. Now, last point. If you might not like this explanation, because you know it doesn't deal with the world outside. It only deals with the world inside. Well, this is an important distinction. The world outside is very important in science. Vedanta, as you know, is not science. Vedanta, as you know, is a solution to the problem of suffering. And the problem of suffering has to do with the world of experience. Not the world outside. The problem of suffering has everything to do with the world that we experience. So if you were to say, but Swamiji, we're not explaining how consciousness can extend 250,000 miles to the moon. We're not explaining that. We're not giving a scientific explanation. Correct. We're not giving a scientific explanation. Vedanta is not science. Vedanta deals with our experience. Everything we experience is pervaded by consciousness. Your consciousness reaches everything you experience. You experience the stars and moon. So how can you say how can you say consciousness is stuck inside your head and body if we say that consciousness pervades everything you experience? Nice way to put it. This is so typical of Vedanta. We can flip everything upside down. Instead of saying consciousness is in your body, are you conscious of your body? Your body is an object present in your mind, correct? You're aware of your, just as you're aware of the stars and moon, you're aware of your body. You experience your body. The body that you experience indirectly through your tactile sense and through your eyes, there isn't a body out there. Is a body outside, and that's the body that science deals with. But in Vedanta, we're less concerned about this body. We'll let science and doctors take care of the body outside. Vedanta deals with the body inside our minds. The body we experience is a physical body in our minds. And now, that body inside your mind is a body inside consciousness. This is where we flip it around. Instead of saying consciousness is inside the body, from this very external scientific standpoint, we flip it around and we say that the body you experience in your mind, that body is in consciousness. Instead of saying consciousness is in the body, we turn it around and say the body is in consciousness. From an external scientific point of view, if you want to say consciousness pervades this body, fine. But from a very profound Vedantic standpoint, the body you experience is the body that appears in your mind. And that body that appears in your mind appears in consciousness. Not that consciousness is in the body is in consciousness. In this way, we're using heavy logic, pure logic, to establish the fact that your experience of limited consciousness stuck inside your body doesn't hold up logically. Doesn't hold up logically according to this ancient worldview of perception, and doesn't hold up logically from this modern perspective, looking at the universe within your mind. All right, let's go on to the next verse and the next argument. Nahi bhanadrate sattvam, nahi bhanadrate sattvam, narte bhanam chito chitaha, narte bhanam chito chitaha, chit sambhedo pichadhyasad, chit sambhedo pichadhyasad, rate te, yeah. Rate te naham advayaha, rate te naham advayaha. More logic. Heavy logic. Here, the topic for manana is this particular doubt. We experience duality. Vedanta says that your consciousness is the same as non-dual Brahman. Vedanta says your consciousness is identical to non-dual Brahman, but with regard to your consciousness, you are the conscious observer. Everything else is known to you. There's duality between knower and known, between observer and observed. So from the standpoint of your consciousness, there seems to be a lot of duality, knower, known, observer, observed. You are the observer and the world of objects is observed, duality. So how do we recognize, how do we reconcile this apparent duality in our experience with the Vedantic teaching, the Advaita realization that your consciousness is non-different from non-dual Brahman? How can your consciousness be non-dual? How can anything be non-dual? This is a little sophisticated. Here's the problem. When you try to prove non-duality, the moment you're using logic, you've entered into the world of duality. Logic is part of the world of duality. Logic is a tool that exists in the world of duality. How can that tool that exists in the world of duality possibly be used to prove non-duality? You get the point. What we're looking at, very sophisticated, we're looking at the limitations of logic. Logic within this world of duality is extremely powerful within the world of duality. But if you want to establish non-duality, logic cannot reach to that non-duality. Logic cannot prove non-duality, but logic can negate duality. Notice the difference. Logic can't positively prove non-duality, but logic can negate duality. Anything that we, anywhere that we find duality, any situation in which we experience duality. Right now, you experience yourself as different from me. There's an experience of duality. Any such experience can be negated by logic. Logic can't prove non-duality, but logic can negate duality. Logic can negate everything. And what we're going to use is a powerful logical tool. The common Latin term, reductio ad absurdum. Reductio ad absurdum. To reduce to the absurd is the logical term. This is commonly used in Western philosophy, and it's used extensively in Vedanta. And we're going to wield that particular kind of logic right now to dismiss duality. Of course, we've already gone through this in a much less logical form. We did it in a much simpler way by observing the difference between form and content. So the form pot is not a thing at all. It is nama and rupa, name and form. It is mere appearance. The clay is what is real. So we've used this approach to establish the mithyatva, the mithyatva of the world. And here you see me pausing and struggling because we have no English equivalent for mithyatva. We can't say falsity of the world. We can't say the illusory nature of the world. Both of those expressions are defective. Our use of the word mithya refers to a dependent reality. The pot is mithya, showing that it is a dependent reality. It's not as real as the clay. It exists, it is experienced, but it's not as real as clay. The pot exists dependent on clay. The pot can go away, clay remains. So this is our more accessible explanation for how our experience of duality can be dismissed. Just as your experience, if I have two or three, I do have another pot here. Good. So here you have an experience of duality. You experience two pots, but there's only one clay. So by shifting our perspective from the duality of two pots to the oneness of clay, by shifting our perspective, we dismiss duality, and we can do the same for the entire cosmos. The entire cosmos is not two, but an infinite number of objects, every object being nama and rupa, name and form. And just as these two objects exist depending on one clay, in the same way the infinite objects in the universe exist depending on one non-dual Brahman. We've used that before. Now we get some very sophisticated logic to prove the same thing. And here, we'll go through the logic. He begins, Nahi bhanat rate sattvam. Na sattvam. There is no existent object. Na sattvam. There is no existent object, bhanat rate. Without bhana, without appearance. And as I said before, experience is better. Appearance. To translate bhana as appearance puts too much emphasis on our power of sight. But we have five senses. So instead of translating bhana as appearance, it does mean appearance, but in context, kind of experience is perhaps a better translation. So he, indeed, nasattvam, nothing exists, bhanat rate, in the absence of experience. If there's no experience, it doesn't exist. Now, this is a little, this is quite Vedantic. If you can't, I'll paraphrase, if you can't experience it, it doesn't exist. That's, I'm paraphrasing this first line. Now, then the commentator says, for example, Shashavishana, the horns of a shasha, of a rabbit. So the horns of a rabbit. Have you ever experienced the horns of a rabbit? No. If you haven't experienced it, it doesn't exist. So this is very Vedantic. If it can't be experienced, it doesn't exist. Now, many of you are thinking that sounds very non-scientific because there are so many things that exist that we understand through science, things that we can't directly experience, but they exist. Like radio waves. Do you experience radio waves? Right now, radio waves are passing through your body. Do you experience them? No. Now notice, this first line takes this very Vedantic perspective and says, if you can't experience it, it doesn't exist, like the hairs of a horn. And that goes against, 100%, it goes against modern science, which says there are so many things we can't experience and yet they exist. How do we reconcile this? We've already had this discussion. Is this a science text? We're not studying science. We're studying Advaita Vedanta. The realm of science is a world outside. The realm of Vedanta is what you experience. I'll say that again. It is so fundamental. The realm of science is the external world. The realm of Vedanta is what you experience. Vedanta is not science. Somebody called it once science of spirituality. That's really a misleading term. Vedanta deals with what you experience. And that's 100% okay. As we said, the problem of suffering is a problem that's within experience. Vedanta doesn't attempt to explain the external world. That's the role of science. Vedanta is meant to help us free ourselves from suffering, that suffering is within the realm of experience. So from the standpoint of science, you can reject this first line. If you can't experience it, it doesn't exist. Scientifically, incorrect. Vedantically, 100% correct. We're only interested in what we can experience. If you can't experience it, for all intents and purposes, it has no existence for you, right? If you can't experience it, it has no existence for you. So, nasattvam, there is no existence, bhanat, rate, without experience. If it can't be experienced, it doesn't exist. Now, what about, so existence depends upon experience. Second line, experience depends upon consciousness. Second line says, the first two words are run together there. For our Sanskrit students, look at that. Na rite. Rite is an indeclinable word. It means without. Rite. Na rite becomes narte. That's confusing. So rite, chittaha rite. Without consciousness, chit here is consciousness. Ritaha rite. Chittaha rite. Without consciousness, na bhanam, there is no appearance, there is no experience. Na bhanam, there's no experience. Chittaha rate, without consciousness. Achittaha, that's our general context for anything inert. So chittaha, achittaha, for anything insentient, like the word sattvam in a prior verse, in a prior line. Look at the sequence that's being built up here. Again, this is reductio ad ver, I have a hard time with Latin. Reductio ad absurdum. So reduction to the absurd. Look at the sequence. First line says, if you can't, existence, first line says, existence depends on experience. Second line says, experience depends upon consciousness. That's not so complicated. So first line, existence depends upon, let me put it up on the board. I think this is just to show you the connections. Okay. So, in the first line, it said that existence sattva existence depends upon experience. Let's see. Bhana. Let me get the Sanskrit words here. Bhana, experience. Okay, so far? So, first line, sattva, existence, depends upon bhana, experience. If you can't experience it, it doesn't exist. Again, not the scientific perspective, the Vedantic perspective. But now, experience in the second line, na rate chittaha, without consciousness, na bhanam, there's no experience. Experience depends upon chit, consciousness. Is it still on the board? No, I'm running out of room. Let me put it down here. I have to get used to using this board. So, bhana, experience, depends upon chit, consciousness. So, watch this reductio ad absurdum. I'm still struggling with the Latin. Existence depends upon experience. Experience depends upon consciousness. Obviously, experience, right? What you're experiencing right now couldn't exist without consciousness. The tricky part comes in the third line. In the third line, just stay up here. In the third line, he says, chit sambhedaha api na adhyasat. He says there's no chit sambheda. Sambheda means sambandha for our Sanskrit students. Connection, association. Sambheda means sambandha. Sambandha, association, is much more common than sambheda. Chit sambandha. So there is no chit sambandha. There is no, the na is in the second part, na adhyasat. Na adhyasat, without adhya, I have to come back to that. There is no connection. Let me put it up here on the board and then I'll sit down and try to explain this. This use of this reduction to absurdity is a sophisticated logical argument, and we're going to see the last step here. Is it still on the board? Okay, so in fact, let me put it over here, so make sure it's on the board. So there has to be a chit sambheda. I'm going to use the word sambandha. association. So here's the argument that's being built up. There's no existence without experience. If you can't experience it, it doesn't exist. There's no experience without consciousness, obviously. And this consciousness has to be in a sambandha, in a relationship with the object. So only when consciousness is in relationship with an object, only then can it be experienced. Right now you're experiencing me. The only way you can experience me is if there's a connection between me and your consciousness. Let me sit down. Okay. There we are. So, here's the tricky part. And here's where this reduction to absurdity finally comes up. There has to be a connection. Finally, let me go back to the slide. For there to be a connection which allows you to experience an object. So sattva, the existence of an object, is bhana, experienced by you. That experience takes place due to chit, consciousness. And that consciousness is in sambandha, association with the object. If there's no association between your consciousness and me, how can you experience me? Let me come back here. If there's no association between your consciousness and me, you can't experience me. And here's the bottom line for this very sophisticated logic. How can there be an association between your consciousness and me? Your consciousness is a reality. Remember, we defined reality, that which doesn't come and go. And we also we have to go back to an earlier discussion where we discerned three levels of reality. Do you remember that discussion? We discerned an absolute reality, paramarthika satta, which is more real than empirical reality, vyavaharika satta, which is more real than projected reality, the reality of your dreams, which is pratibhasika satta. I hope you remember that discussion from an earlier class. Here's the problem. Your consciousness is more real than what you experience. It's of a different order of reality. This is the bottom line here, and it's a little bit sophisticated. In order for there to be an experience, you would think that two things can have a connection, an association. So my two hands can contact each other and be associated with each other. But how about my real hands and some dream hands? Can there be any association, in fact, better than hand? Here. Suppose this is a dream pot. This is a pot that only exists in a dream. This is a real hand, but a dream pot. Can there be any association? Can a real hand hold on to a dream pot? Doesn't make any sense, right? A real hand can hold on to a real pot, but a real hand cannot hold on to a dream pot. They have no connection, no association. In order for there to be a connection or association, they have to be of the same order of reality. If this were a dream hand, A dream hand can hold on to a dream pot. If it's a real hand and a real pot, no problem. There's an association only when the two things are of the same order of reality. And here's the problem. Your consciousness belongs to that paramarthika satta, that absolute level of reality. But everything you experience is part of this world of names and forms. So, if your consciousness is more real and what you experience is less real, how can there be any experience? And you get the point. If this is a real hand and this is a dream pot, there's no way for there to be any connection. In the same way, your consciousness is more real than the world of names and forms that you experience. So how can you experience anything at all? How can that sambandha, that association between consciousness and the world that you experience, how can that association take place? And end of the third line, he says, it takes place adhyasat, due to superimposition. Because of superimposition, adhyasat, there can be, only because of superimposition, can there be an association between your consciousness and everything you experience. But adhyasa, as you remember, superimposition is based on ignorance. You superimpose the snake on the rope. The snake is not as real as the rope. The rope is real. The snake is superimposed. Finally speaking, there's no snake. There's only rope. The snake appears on the rope due to superimposition. But superimposition is based on ignorance. When you discover it's only a rope, the snake is gone. Do you see where this is going? The only reason you can experience anything at all is due to superimposition. What that means is, in your experience, I'll try to make this a little less logical and a little more accessible. In your experience right now, your consciousness is what's real. Everything that you experience is less real. Just like the difference between waking objects and dream objects. Waking objects are more real than dream objects. So your consciousness is more real than what you experience. Logically speaking, there's no possibility of connection between what is more real and what is less real. There's no possibility of connection between a waking hand and a dream pot. There's no possibility of connection between your real consciousness and the world of names and forms. How do we account for this experience then? Adhyasat. It is superimposed. And specifically what it means is you falsely attribute reality to everything you experience. That's adhyasa, superimposition. You falsely attribute reality to what you experience. What you experience is less real than your consciousness, but you superimpose the same kind of reality on everything you experience. Suppose Vedanta goes in deeply enough and you stop doing that. Then you recognize what is real is consciousness, and everything you experience is less real. Everything you experience is merely nama rupa. Everything, it's just like saying, when you understand that the duality of these two pots is superimposed by your perspective. If you shift your perspective and don't superimpose the division, the duality between these two pots, if you recognize there's only one clay, what happens to the duality of these pots? Gone. So, in the same way, we'll finish this verse now. Sorry. I'm struggling to make this as accessible as possible. So forgive me for pausing here. Your consciousness is what's real. Everything you experience is nama rupa superimposed on your consciousness. That's what this verse is saying. Adhyasat. Adhyasat rate. Without that rate in the fourth line. Adhyasat rate. Without superimposition, there is no chit sambheda. There is no connection between consciousness and what you experience. That association between your consciousness and what you experience depends upon superimposition, and superimposition is the snake on the rope. It is false. Therefore, when you attribute reality to everything you experience, you've made a mistake. When you cease attributing reality to everything you experience, then tena, in the last line, tena, because of this, aham, I am advayaha, non-dual. Non-dual consciousness. Tena, for this reason, since we have just reduced the reality of everything you experience, we've reduced it to absurdity, so the existence is reduced to experience is reduced to consciousness depends on association, and to be conscious of an object depends on association, and that association depends on superimposition. This is the reductio ad absurdum. Bottom line is, what you experience is merely nama rupa. It is not a reality. The reality is consciousness. The consciousness because of which nama rupa is observed. That consciousness is non-dual. Nama rupa doesn't disturb that reality. Just to make this last point, does the duality of these pots disturb the non-duality of clay? Right? The non-duality of clay is a fact, unaffected by the duality of pots. In the same way, the non-duality of your consciousness is a fact unaffected by the duality of what you experience, because what you experience is not as real as your consciousness. And that's the point of this very sophisticated verse. We'll conclude here. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, Sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kashchaduhka bhag bhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityorma amritangamaya om shanti 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 om tat sat.